Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, Hillary Clinton has canceled her campaign events over the next 2 days after collapsing as she left a 9/11 event yesterday in New York. Her doctors say she had pneumonia, was on medication, and was dehydrated and exhausted. What will this mean for the presidential campaign as we are less than 70 days from Election Day? Black Lives Matter, they plan on going to Capitol Hill and lobbying members of Congress when it comes to their concerns. We'll talk to one of the activists about that. Also, more national anthem protests and displays of unity in the NFL. What is going on there? Seahawks players link arms and unify. Other players, Black Power fists, also take a knee. We'll break that thing down for you as well. Also, folks, living legend Harry Belafonte will join us with criminal justice activist Carmen Perez to discuss Social Justice Music Arts Festival. They will have in October called Many Rivers to Cross, plus they'll break down the importance of advocacy and activism in the entertainment world. Plus, a new documentary sheds light on two academic success stories out of Chicago's South Side. I will talk with executive producer Wes Moore and one of the young men in the film. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Clinton was supposed to give an interview this morning on the Tom Joyner Morning Show. That has been canceled. She's also canceled a 2-day trip to California following her abrupt departure from a 9/11 ceremony yesterday where she complained she was overheated. Folks, this is video that was taken as she was going out of the venue. And you will see in just a moment, that is her van awaiting her. Secret Service protection is there as well. You see there where she literally stumbles. They have to hold her up, place her into the van. She ended up going to the nearby apartment of her daughter, Chelsea Clinton, where she was later seen coming out of the apartment saying it all was well. Her doctors made it clear that she, first of all, the initial statement from her campaign was that she was suffering from dehydration as well as exhaustion. As I said, 90 minutes after this took place, then she came out of the apartment of Chelsea Clinton, waving to the crowd, even posed for a photo with a young girl. She then left for her home in Chappaqua, New York. Now, of course, here's a statement that was released by her doctor. Quote, Secretary Clinton has been experiencing a cough related to allergies. On Friday, during follow-up evaluation of her prolonged cough, she was diagnosed with pneumonia. She was put on antibiotics and advised to rest and modify her schedule. While at this morning's event, she became overheated and dehydrated. I have just examined her, and she is now rehydrated and recovering nicely. And of course, many of her critics have been complaining about her coughing. Now we know exactly what the issue as well. The question is, what will this mean going forward? Because now her health is now a campaign issue. Let's go to our panel here. We have Spencer Overton joining us with the Joint Center for Political Economic Studies. Michelle Bernard joins us as well. Michelle, of course. And of course, we also have, first of all, before I go back to them, I want to go to Corey Hebert just 1 second. Also we have Ann Eugene Craig here, third vice chair of the Maryland Republican Party. Dr. Hebert joins us right now. Of course, he is a noted physician, also a television expert. He's with the CEO of Community Health TV. Dr. Hebert, doctor told her, look, take it easy, rest. She should have followed his advice, correct? Follow her advice, correct?
Exactly. But I tell you what, when Beyonce canceled in Belgium, did she follow the advice? Yes, she did. And she didn't collapse at the next venue. Basically, you have to think about this in a grand scheme. When you are traveling all over the world on airplanes, exchanging all types of viruses with everybody else, including your new press corps, which happened last week. She's also living in very stressful situations, having to deal with Donald Trump and everybody else. She's got some advanced age on her. It's just a setup to get pneumonia. So I want everybody just to chill, because in reality, you know, this happens to a lot of people, because people that are hard charging, that are in stressful situations, not getting enough sleep, this can happen to anybody. So let's just get that clear. I don't want everybody, you know, in the camp to start getting worked up to say, oh, Lord, what are we going to do? It's not, we don't need to sound the alarms just quite yet.
She's canceled a couple, a two-day event. As a doctor, how long should she be off the campaign trail, getting diagnosed on Friday, having antibiotics?
Yeah, it's hard to say because we don't know what type of pneumonia you can have. I mean, granted, there are viral pneumonias, bacterial pneumonias, even fungal pneumonias. But more than likely, what she had was is called community-acquired pneumonia, also known as walking pneumonia. Now, I don't like people to say that because walking pneumonia, you think that you might get double pneumonia. None of that actually really is real. The reality is that walking pneumonia is community-acquired. It's caused by a mycoplasma, which is a really weird type of organism that you just have to just get some rest, take some antibiotics and chill. But what may have happened to her is that when you take antibiotics, as all of us out there know, then it causes you to feel a little dehydrated and it causes you to have a little bit of hard work on your kidneys. And your kidneys, as we know, what regulates your liquid intake and your liquid outgo. So the problem is that she may have been taking those antibiotics and caused her not to drink as much water and not to drink as much fluid, which could cause a fluid imbalance, which would make her look like she looked yesterday. So how long should she stay out is hard to say, but I would say for at least 3 to 4 days until her doctor says, look, you're clear, let's get it rolling. But she needs to get some rest. That's what she needs to do, because regardless of pneumonia or any other kind of pneumonia, she needs to relax because she needs to be the person that we need her to be and look the way she needs to look so that we won't have all these, you know, people saying that she's not fit for the presidency.
Dr. Corey Hebert, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Spencer, real quick, how critical is this? I mean, is this major when it comes to this campaign?
You know, it's not major. She's a human being. You know, health is something we all go through, right? But the problem is it plays into two of Donald Trump's narratives. One, he's kind of constructed this thing about health, and this plays into it, this episode. Another issue is truth and veracity and credibility. He'll say, hey, see, she's not okay. She's saying she's okay. This is another example of her not being truthful about being healthy. That will be his kind of narrative.
Michelle, what's interesting is she has released some of her medical history. He's released none. We all know about that farce of a letter that so-called doctor released as well. So it's interesting that she's been attacked about her health, but he hasn't released his health or tax records.
Exactly. And I would say I don't think it's going to play well for women across the country. It will inure to the benefit of Hillary Clinton. But the attacks on her health by Donald Trump, I think, are going to hurt his campaign somewhat, because when you hear people saying, you know, advanced age and pneumonia, people get pneumonia. People, you either die or you grow old. And this really should not be an issue. She's got to take a couple days of rest and she'll be fine.
Andrew? Sorry, Eugene. I'm sorry.
Andrew's a good friend of mine, but I'll put it this way. You know, I don't think Donald Trump should be criticizing her. She's actually been more transparent.
But he will.
Yeah. But I mean, I'll put it this way. She's not flying back to Trump Tower every single night. She actually sleeps on the road. You know, I'm not a Hillary Clinton supporter or a Donald Trump supporter, but one thing I will concede is that she actually does sleep on the road. She actually does stay in the places that she campaigns in, whereas though Donald Trump sleeps in his bed at Trump Tower every single night. So, you know, when you're going through a vigorous schedule like that, you should expect some level of stress. And, you know, she's caught pneumonia. She takes some days off, get back at it in about a week.
And also, don't you, I think it speaks a lot to her character and her desire to win the presidency that despite what her doctor ordered, she was out there going. She was on the road doing what she's supposed to be doing and campaigning and celebrating. Or I shouldn't say celebrating, but recognizing the tragedy that happened 15 years ago on 9/11.
But the thing that we still have to recognize is that this has been a constant drumbeat in conservative media on
Absolutely.
Talk show, on television, and so you don't play into your opponent's hands.
Yeah, the issue with this election cycle is that the Alex Jones and the Roger Stones of the world have become normalized. Under normal circumstances, we'll keep those guys out to the far right, out at bay, out of the fringe. You know, they're now driving the cycle because
God! I mean, look, all of a sudden white supremacists are being called the alt-right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, can I just say though, like from a woman's perspective, this to me, people work hard. They get ill. As the doctor just told us, to me, the criticism of her health at this point in time is no different than years ago when people acted as if pregnancy was a disability. Gotcha. And yeah. It's not.
All right, folks, another story that we're covering right now was taking place this week in Washington, D.C. Black Lives Matter, they're coming to Capitol Hill to lobby members of Congress when it comes to criminal justice issues. Of course, we've been covering them going, taking to the streets, protesting in cities all across the country. But this week, Black Youth Project 100 teaming up with the National Black Justice Coalition to bring nearly 40 activists to D.C. on Wednesday to sit down with congressional members to talk about policies and about helping the African American community. Joining us right now, Samantha Masters. She's a member of Black Youth Project 100. So, Samantha, let's talk about this. So, exactly how did this come about, and why this effort to Congress? Because previously, the New York Justice League also, when they had their march from New York to D.C., presented Congress with a list of demands. Why is this critically important now?
So, I think it's a multi-pronged strategy. We are deeply invested at BYP 100 and the National Black Justice Coalition to building power in the streets, to building momentum and grassroots advocacy and action from young people who are tired and fed up with the system, and taking those demands to the people in power who are elected to transform our communities. And they have largely not done their job. And so we're bringing the movement and the work to them to really talk about our policy platforms. Our brilliant policy chair, Janae Bonsu, has worked on the Agenda to Build Black Futures, which is a foreground to the Vision for Black Lives, which was released August 1st.
So who are you meeting with? Because Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, has been the biggest one blocking the criminal justice reform bill in the United States Senate. You have, of course, Bob Goodlatte, congressman from Virginia, who is blocking anything in the House Judiciary Committee. As well, even when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, that bill is being offered by Republican Jim Sensenbrenner. So are you meeting with Black caucus members and white Republicans?
Absolutely. So we are meeting with our elected officials, with our chapters. Our chapter delegates will be meeting with their elected officials. And so be those representatives, white or Black, we are absolutely presenting our policy agenda to them, recognizing that we represent people in their communities, we represent their constituencies. And this is just a first pass to build power with our membership at BYP 100. This is not the end of the road. So we will absolutely be back on the Hill to push for the vision for Black lives.
Spencer, why does this matter?
It matters because it's critical that young folks are engaged. We talk about, oh, hey, the deal's already been made. You're being naive in terms of these extremes. Hey, it's important that they're here, that they're at the table. If anything, they may send a message to conservatives that this is a very reasonable a compromise. They may move the needle in terms of the playing field and the spectrum about what's impossible. So I'm glad that they're here. A lot of folks have criticized the Movement for Black Lives for not focusing on policy. Here's a concrete example of focusing on policy.
Eugene, it was very interesting because when Congressman Bobby Scott had a bill about police reporting, folks have been killed in custody. That bill was previously passed in the previous Congress, but then it was not voted upon in the next one. But what was interesting is when they had all those protests around the country, Scott said, y'all better make a decision. Do you want your names on those signs?
Yep.
The bill was passed. So the reality is, unlike all the critics out there, Black Lives Matter protesters have actually driven public policy changes.
I agree. There is a bill that's going to be forthcoming from the Judiciary House Judiciary Committee, particularly with Chairman Goodlatte, that has his signature and stamp approval on. That's going to be
when.
I do know that there's a broad coalition of groups, outside groups, that have been pushing this, particularly FreedomWorks and some other organizations. I know Our Street's been involved with it. I think the Joint Center may actually be involved as well. But I do know it's coming out of pipeline. A speaker supports it, and Black Lives Matter has played a big part in it.
Michelle. And then
I think I'm just glad that the youth are out there and people are understanding that these are not people who are somehow crazy
right.
for engaging and understand how the process works in terms of grassroots development, but also going to the Hill and doing everything you can to change policy.
Samantha, final comment.
So I want to just disabuse us of the notion that this is just about police reform. We are supporting the Healthcare Equity Accountability Act. We are supporting the College for All Act. And so our our platform is based in divesting from systems that oppress black people and in investing in solutions to our liberation. It's not just police reform, it's across the board with queer and trans people and black women at the center of it all.
All right, Samantha, we appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
We'll be there with you guys covering as well.
Come and join us.
All right, folks, coming up next, presidential race is tightening according to all the polls. What must Hillary Clinton do to ensure significant black turnout? We'll talk with top pollster Cornell Belcher next, also later in the show. Harry Belafonte will talk about the issue of justice in America, plus protests around the NFL when it comes to the national anthem. We'll break all that down right here, News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Tom Joyner, good morning. We are simulcasting Tom Joyner Morning Show and TV One as well. So you're right, great day. Houston, Texas won. Texas A&M Aggies won. And the Cowboys lost. A glorious day.
glorious.
Let me give a shout out to First Emmanuel Lutheran Church, Tom. I spoke there on Saturday. All the folks in Chicago had a great time there as well. Tom, let's get right to it. This election, of course, polls are tightening all across the country. Hillary Clinton's lead shrinking against Donald Trump. If you look at the ABC Washington Post poll, voter preference, Clinton 46%, Trump 41%. Gary Johnson, doesn't know about Aleppo, is at 9%. And Jill Stein, of course, with the Green Party, is at 2%. But the issue, though, is what is happening in the various states. And when it comes to those various states poll, some polls show Clinton is up by 2 points in the margin of error in Florida. She's up in North Carolina. It's tightening in New Hampshire. Trump is up in Georgia by only a couple of points, and also Arizona. But the real question, what does this mean for black folks? What must Hillary Clinton do to ensure she's getting turnout of the Obama coalition? We're joined by Cornell Belcher, a top pollster who joins us right now. Cornell, what's up?
Good morning. Good morning, everyone.
Very cute suit you got on. All right, then. So let's. So Tom, my lord, you ought to see this suit. It's like cute somebody from suit? England. I mean, Jay Anthony Brown, lord.
Cute.
Jay, if you saw this suit, you will see exactly why I called it cute. All right. So Cornell. You released a recent poll where you talked about there's some ambivalence of Hillary Clinton among young black voters.
Yeah. Actually, the poll was leaked. Roland, I didn't release it.
Okay.
You don't want to see your poll in the New York Times cover. But yeah, and I think what the problem is, and you see that number 93% supporting her, it isn't actually so much about the percentage of support for Hillary Clinton as it is the coalition, right? So John Kerry did well among African Americans. African Americans disliked George Bush a great deal, but African Americans weren't the most likely voter in that electorate at that point. So you're talking about the expanding of the electorate. What we were able to do with the Obama campaign was actually grow the electorate. We got 43% of the white vote, the same as John Kerry did, but we won a majority. That was based off of increasing the percentage of African American votes so that a state like Ohio, which was 12 or 13% under John Kerry, became 15%, and we won that, and we got 141,000 black votes out of Ohio than John Kerry did. And remember, Roland, we didn't win Ohio by a great deal, and John Kerry lost Ohio by, 100,000 or so votes.
In 2008, Obama wins North Carolina by 14,100 votes because of the intensity of black turnout.
That expansion of the African-American electorate, which disproportionately are younger voters. Now, we talk a lot about the millennials, but the millennials are key to this. When younger voters are a large proportion of the electorate than our senior voters, you know, Democrats tend to do very well. In the off year in 2010 and 2014, you saw seniors make up a large proportion of the electorate, and that Obama coalition sort of stepped back. And if they step back this time around, because right now in the ABC poll, it's not like she's doing better among white voters than Barack Obama did. She's, 36-37%. We got 38% in 2012. I think it's fool's gold to think that she's going to do dramatically better among white voters, even though than Barack Obama did, even though they make a big deal of her doing better among college educated. And the aggregate is still about the same.
Let's get to money, because here's the reality. The Clinton campaign is being aggressive in spending money trying to flip Republican white women. Many others say, look, you better ensure you are properly investing for black folks, because you're spending a lot more time and energy trying to flip a conservative white woman when your money might be better served trying to ensure massive black, Hispanic, young voter turnout.
Do they get it yet?
I can't answer. I can't question.
No, he can't answer this. Answer this, Sybil. I've talked to folks who have been talking to the Clinton campaign, even this weekend. No, they don't get it. Cornell, go ahead.
Well, I would say that you know, look, the resources have to be put there in order to keep this electorate expanded. However, Roland, at the same time, I'm tired of us going and begging the campaigns to do this. It's time for us to have our own PACs and our own sort of funding mechanisms so that we can turn out African Americans around the issues that are important to us and hold these elected officials accountable. When you talk to young voters, that's what they want, more so than the idea that we're going to fall in love with another candidate. We need to fall in love with our issues and hold these elected officials accountable for coming to us and taking on our issues.
We're 60. Go ahead.
8 weeks out. We're 8 weeks tomorrow out. What is the bottom line in terms of getting them to recognize this before the registration deadline is up, especially for these millennials?
Cornell?
If you want the police to stop beating you around the head and shooting you in the streets in your communities, you have to exercise your political power. You know, Barack Obama's president of the United States because of black power. Plain and simple. If you want to stop what's happening in your community, you want to change what's happening in your community, exercise your power and hold these elected officials accountable. You cannot step back from the poll. You got to keep it going.
Roland, Jay was at a club and there was an unofficial poll done at the club. Play, are you there?
They were asking who's going to vote for Donald Trump, and nobody applauded. They asked who's going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and he said it was crickets.
and then ask who wished that you could have another term
for Obama
and the crowd went wild.
But
now, I know there's nothing scientific about that poll, but that says something.
Especially to a pollster.
But it does say something. But again, we've got to stop acting like it's all about Hillary Clinton. No, it's about us and our issues in our community. So go out and vote. Even if you're not in love with Hillary Clinton, you better be in love with holding these elected officials accountable. So get out there and vote to hold these elected officials accountable.
But here's the question. Have you though heard those, if what you're saying, have you heard that ad on black radio? Have you seen those ads on television? Because that's how you make the argument. So for instance, I'm trying to figure out why the Hillary Clinton campaign hasn't brought out the Central Park Five to say, hey, if Donald Trump had his way, we would have gotten the death penalty, even though we were later exonerated.
I got to think some of it's coming, and some of it from the outside.
It's 8 weeks. They better hurry the hell up. because the reason I'm raising that point, because as Sybil just said, early voting is critical. We see North Carolina, where the federal court said they had a laser-like focus on targeting black voters because black folks turned out in the first week of early voting and on Sundays. Half of the counties in North Carolina, 23 in 2012, now slashed to 12 voting on Sunday. And so that's going to have to be an even more effort to ensure our folks are turning out.
But it starts with the campaign, but also the party, but also outside groups. And it starts on shows like this with you and your panel, sort of, even if you're not for Hillary Clinton, even my Republican brothers on the other side are not for Hillary Clinton. They've got to be for black power and for us being able to change what's going on in our communities.
Tom?
Cornell, you and your cute little suit have some work to do because it's really just saying that just talking the talk is not enough, and her people are not getting the message.
Yeah. Well, guess what? I guarantee they're going to hear this damn show. And I advise them to put some money behind a black effort because they need a surge of black voters. 2.4% increase for Obama in Ohio in 2012. That's how he won the state.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Good job, Roland.
Tom, Sybil, Jay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Roland. Thanks, Cornell.
Thank 25. You. Pass the
hour. Cornell, we appreciate it, folks. Coming up next, we'll talk about the protests in the NFL on 9/11, the 15th anniversary. Guess what? Seattle Seahawks said it's all about unity. What the hell was that about? Also, we'll bring you my interview with the first part of my interview with Harry Belafonte as he talks about bringing some of music's finest together in the fight for justice and racial equality in America. 24 for the hour. News 1 Now, TV 1.
My name is Leah Daughtry. I am the CEO of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. You only get one vote. Use it.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, folks, the NFL kicked off their 2016 season on yesterday. It fell on the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. You saw lots of flag displays, first responders, police, and fire all across NFL stadiums. But You also saw some moments of protest. The first video you saw there, Seattle Seahawks, they chose to stand with their arms locked in a show of solidarity. I'll explain to you what that actually meant later. On the other side of the field, four Miami Dolphins players chose to kneel during the national anthem. In Kansas City, Marcus Peters chose to protest with a raised fist, while other Chiefs players locked arms. And over the weekend, a number of high school players around the country took part in protests. Actually, for the NFL, a total of 14 players were involved in protests. One Massachusetts football player, Mike Apong, took a knee during the national anthem. He tweeted last night, quote, "My coaches and principals have decided to suspend me for one game." Really? We've also reached out to him, trying to get him on the show. High schools from across the country took part in silent protests. Wagner High School in Louisville, Kentucky. Woodrow Wilson High School in Philadelphia. Lincoln High School in Nebraska. And Auburn High School in Rockford, Illinois. All of them, of course, as a result of Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers, him starting this in the preseason. They play tonight. We'll see what he does in that game. Folks, even outside of football, a women's volleyball team in West Virginia joined in on the protest as well. Now, what's interesting about all of this is that you saw the the Seattle Seahawks protest. Doug Baldwin of the Seahawks actually released a video on Twitter the night before the game stating why they were doing it. So when I saw that, I tweeted him. I said, dude, you got to explain what this protest is all about. He then texted me. We had a long conversation back and forth where he said that this really is an attempt to be able to get moderate whites to accept why Kaepernick is protesting. And he used Dr. King and his views as a rationale. I'm still trying to figure out what he's talking about because it makes no sense. Let's go to our panel here. We have Spencer, Michelle, as well as Eugene. So here's what's interesting about all of this. Folks are condemning Kaepernick for protesting. And yesterday, the NFL played a video from President Barack Obama calling for unity on the 15th anniversary of 9/11. In numerous NFL stadiums, the president got booed.
Yep.
So I find it interesting that there are people mad at Kaepernick for protesting, saying he's unpatriotic, but yet when they say, oh, we should all stand for the flag and national anthem, yet when the president of the United States gives a video talking about unity on 9/11, he gets booed.
Yep.
And no one says anything.
You're saying something, and thank goodness. It is, I don't even know what to say. The president did the right thing in calling for unity. I think what the football players are doing and other sports teams are doing across the country is fantastic, but particularly football, because black men are so predominant in the game.
Absolutely.
And the NFL relies on them, and this is a way for people who go out and cheer and they want their football team to win, and their football teams are basically being run by black men, to understand that this is a very serious thing.
Yeah, and Roland, I am definitely all for social consciousness in terms of athletes, etc. My big thing is I don't think that we should cede the flag or patriotism. I'm not saying that you're suggesting that. What I'm saying is I'd rather be on the situation of with the president, where folks are booing him because they don't necessarily value black life, or they don't value him in terms of an African-American leader. I'd rather be on that side than on the side of other folks wrapped up on the flag, putting black folks down.
But here's the deal, though.
The same folk that are more outraged that Colin Kaepernick and others are protesting rather than an issue that he's actually protesting have been the same folk that have been disrespecting the president for the last 8 years.
It's
the same crowd that asked for his birth certificate, same crowd that asked for his college transcripts, and it's the same crowd that's probably backing Donald Trump. So my issue is this: you know, I've been a vocal supporter of Colin Kaepernick. I've been a vocal supporter of folk that are actually using their platform to take a stand on issues that affect all of us. I mean, you can't realistically ask your players to go out here and perform as superstars by day and then get held up at gunpoint by cops by night. I mean, that's not a reasonable act, and then, you know, get upset when they protest in the second act.
Well, and the thing, here's my whole point about it. Look, I don't think anybody's ceding anything to them, because the reality is this. There's already a report out where the cop who threatened Ferguson protesters with a gun, actually, they say he was in the wrong.
Yep.
He had a U.S. flag on his uniform. The cop who killed Walter Scott had a flag on his uniform. Here's the reality, and I get what the Seahawks did, but guess what? prosecutors in America, grand juries in America, police unions in America, and the public, they locked arms in a stand of unity with rogue police officers.
Yep.
And so what's interesting to me is that, again, all of a sudden, folks want to say, oh, don't dare, you don't do that, but they are silent on police brutality.
Absolutely.
And then if folks want to invoke Dr. King.
I hate that.
But when Dr. King, they is actually horrible. Go back to the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom speech called I Have a Dream speech, he clearly says that we will never stop until police brutality ends. Yep. Never does not mean only in 63. Right. Never also means if it's happening in 2016, you keep doing it.
Well, the issue is that people bastardize Dr. King's legacy.
Yes.
Most folks don't know Dr. King's legacy.
They haven't even read past one speech.
And so the issue, two lines in a speech, you know, and so folk like to quote that and wrap it around their own little thing, rather than looking at Dr. King's actual full legacy. And because my thing is this, if you know Dr. King, you know police brutality is one of his biggest issues.
But I have a question.
Real quick, is
what the Seattle Seahawks did in any way analogous to how we saw the community come together in the wake of the Dallas shootings with the police officers who were killed in Dallas?
Okay, let me tell you something. I have no idea what the hell they were doing. Because, see, here's a piece here.
What they were doing was not pissing off
their
Seattle white crowd.
And so the deal here is, if you're the Seattle Seahawks, okay, so if you say this is furthering what Kaepernick is doing, okay, what's your next step? Because we know what he's done. Mm-hmm. When he said the first million of his salary is going to social justice organizations, the 49ers have put up $1 million. He's been in contact with various Black Lives Matter people. I personally talked to Colin Kaepernick, and I know what he's doing. I guarantee you're not going to see those players doing something as well.
I put it this way. We need to remember the names of the players that are standing up for us and also support their sponsors if they stick by them.
Yeah. All right, folks. Got to go to a break right now. We come back. Harry Belafonte. You will hear from him as he break down the importance of connecting celebrity and activism and how his upcoming music and arts festival, Many Rivers to Cross, will do just that. Also, I'll talk later with executive producer and author Wes Moore about a new documentary, All the Difference, that focuses on the lives of two young Black men on the south side of Chicago. 24 before top of the hour, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Mayor of the city and county of Denver, you've got just one vote. Use it.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
He is 89 years old. Harry Belafonte has been on the front lines all his life in his quest for social justice. In our last interview, we talked about, of course, Colin Kaepernick. That wasn't just it. We talked about a whole bunch of stuff in the more than an hour conversation. We also were joined by Carmen Perez, a social justice activist with Harry Belafonte. They filled me in on the upcoming Music, Arts, and Justice Festival, Many Rivers to Cross. This is the first part of our interview.
The absence of Black presence by celebrity is a serious loss to our potential use of power to make a difference. So I invited all the artists I could think of to come for a two-day festival down in Atlanta to celebrate criminal justice as a festival. It's called Many Rivers to Cross, based upon a great song. And in it, all the artists will sing to songs that in content speak about the plight of Black people. So artist after artist after artist, I looked at all the songs that will be sung. I look at what Jamie Foxx will be saying and what he will sing. I've looked at John Legend and what he will say and what he will sing. I've looked at Alice Smith. I've looked at Common. I've talked to Chuck D, whom I love madly, and what he brings to the table. And I think those who come will be more than rewarded with what they see of Black presence speaking to these issues. I also add this, and I'll be through on this subject. It is that what also surprises me is the number of artists that told me no.
Really?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, there are some artists that told me yes in the light of enthusiasm in the first rush, and were they pressed to really define what would be asked of them, what kind of songs to sing, and what they should be turning their attention to comment on, stepped away. They don't want the blemish. They don't want the burden of responsibility. And I was really quite surprised.
And how did that make you feel?
made me feel sad because the particular people that I'm talking about that stepped away were the ones that I least suspected that would have done that. And because I have no right to hold anybody hostage to what I think and what I want to do, they're exempt from any act of coming on board, so to speak. I don't want to blackmail them into this. So when these artists said no, I said, okay, I hear you.
But you do remember who said no.
I'll never forget. And on occasion, I'll make sure they don't forget either.
I think Mr. B's vision has always been to bring together activists. And a lot of activists are connected to artists. You know, we certainly work with a lot of artists, and working with Mr. Belafonte, you know, he constantly talks about artists are the gatekeepers to truth, they're civilization's radical voice. And we as activists really need to come together to plan what our next move is going to be collectively. We need a black and brown agenda, and we need a strategy in order for implementation, because we are now going to be moving into a different cycle where there are some very negative implications in our communities mm-hmm. because of it. And so I think right now, this has been planned, I think, since Mr. Belafonte has always talked about this. And for me, it's exciting to see that it's now happening. And so I think it's an opportunity for us to also share a stage with artists and also build relationship mm-hmm. with artists who can use their platform to amplify the work that we're doing on the ground.
Carlos,
well, there's also another dimension to this. Why now? Mm-hmm. Why at this particular moment?
Right.
Because here and now, we've never had the issues clearly and sharply drawn as they are today. We never had a black president before that had a backlash. We never had a president that has had the kind of backlash that Barack Obama has had. I mean, race rushed into the room to declare itself alive and present and angry at the idea that there's a black man daring to speak for America in the halls of justice and in the hall of solution globally. White people woke up, most of them were asleep. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever dreamed that Barack Obama would become president. And when crackers woke up to see the White House full with a black voice and black issues that could be discussed from a black perspective, it sent them into orbit. But we never had the nation declare itself so openly on the issues of race as it does today, and certainly as articulated through Trump. I mean, the things that Donald Trump says about Latinos, about blacks, about youth, about criminality, mm-hmm. about women, all the things. Nobody has ever stepped to the forefront with that agenda as openly declared as he has. And I think that that sort of has stimulated millions of people to hit the ground running on issues that he has raised, that so many, I mean, 13 million people who support him, or at least that's the number that's being bantered mm-hmm. around. That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. 13 million is as large as the population of some nations in the world. Well, if you got 13 million people declaring their support for this kind of social philosophy, why are the rest of us sitting back? What are we waiting to happen?
What do you want those in attendance, first artists in the public, when they leave, to do?
I would like for them to get involved in their local organizing efforts. And also, I think one of the things that we're hearing a lot in this election cycle is that we don't have any candidates that we are fully supporting. And I really am asking for the community to go out and vote and to register somebody to vote. And the fact that this is happening right before the election is a perfect opportunity to continue on that path and that message.
The voice of the people is the most powerful tool we have in America. If the community mm-hmm. is not heard from, presidents don't feel they have to do anything. Politicians don't feel they have to do anything except raise money to get reelected on a non-issue campaign.
For you, what do you want to see him do with the gathering that he has not done yet?
Oh, that is a great question. I should have been thinking about that.
Is there something that you want him to do that he hasn't done? And I let you off the hook by saying, is that something that maybe he's done but you want to see more of?
I think Mr. Belafonte has lent his service to the gathering and his vision, and I certainly am working with him so that we could develop these manifestos that could guide new activists and guide the movement. And so I would like for that to come together soon, and for us to continue to spend time together. But I personally know that Mr. Belafonte is 89, and I want to see him live out the rest of his life doing what he loves, and that's music, and that's creation. But lending a voice to the work that we do within the gathering and the movement, and also his vision and his guidance. And certainly I would love to bring as many young people to listen to him, because everything that he says is so on point, and he drops so many gems, and I sometimes feel I wish I could just pocket everything and like hand it out, because Mr. Belafonte has a lot of depth, and he has a lot of wisdom, and so much commitment, and allows us to see things in a very different way. But I personally would like to dismantle the machine that he's always asked us to dismantle.
When the music stops, when the speeches stop, when the dialogue stops on the second, what do you want the artists and the people attending to then do?
When all those things stop, what you've just suggested is that life has ended.
I mean, I didn't mean that weekend.
I mean that
when that they got to go home.
I mean that period of our history. I was reared on the fact that Paul Robeson was my mentor. Mm-hmm. I was in a play in the American Negro Theater. I went to learn about theater. I fell in love with what I saw. And Paul Robeson came to see us as young players, to see what young black artists were doing. There was Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis and Sidney Poitier, this young crowd trying to make its way in the world of the performing arts. And he said that we had chosen a noble profession in the arts because he felt that artists were the gatekeepers of truth. He said artists are the moral compass of civilization, and they're also civilization's radical voice. And when I stepped into the idea of being a performer, it was about spreading the radical thought, about spreading ideas and bringing plays to impact upon audiences about social injustice. The idea that all you do is to entertain and make money is a very recent phenomena. Mm-hmm. We've always had to be paid, but there's never a distinctive line drawn between the entertaining mm-hmm. and being a social voice. That's a recent phenomena. Everybody's off being an entertainer. Very little is being said from the social perspective in great art today. So I expect the artists to leave behind an instructed audience, to leave behind an audience that's been led to someplace emotionally where they'll give thought to the State of the Union.
More of our exclusive with Harry Belafonte tomorrow right here on News One Now. Don't forget the Many Rivers to Cross Festival will take place October 1st and 2nd in Atlanta. Go to Sankofa, SANKOFA.org for tickets and more information. When we come back, we'll profile a documentary airing tonight on PBS about two young black men in Chicago on the South Side trying to make their way. News One Now, TV One, back in a moment.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Rolling Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Folks, when you hear about Chicago in the news, it's rarely positive. Stories about gun violence and police corruption crowd the news cycle. But executive producer Wes Moore is bringing an inspirational story straight out of Chicago's South Side with his new PBS documentary, All the Difference. The film chronicles 5 years in the lives of two black Chicago teens as they navigate out of their South Side neighborhoods through high school, college, and beyond. Here is a sneak peek.
Statistics predict that Robert and Krishan will never get to college. but they have other plans.
God didn't give up on me. My family didn't give up on me. Why should I give up on myself?
I just want to make a positive impact in the society I live in.
See what it takes for these young men to succeed.
I've had a chance to see my mother again. I said, look how far I made it. I made you proud.
All the Difference on POV.
Joining us now is executive producer, author Wes Moore, and Robert Henderson, who's one of the subjects in the film. They join us from Baltimore. Gents, how you doing?
We're doing great, Roland. Great talking to you, man.
Thanks for having us.
So, Wes, I want to start with you, and that is when we talk about this life one has to navigate. I lived and worked in Chicago for 6 years. And when I hear people like Bill O'Reilly and others talk about what's happening in Chicago from their seats in New York, I go, y'all don't know what the hell y'all talking about, because you haven't bothered to literally go there and understand that. I remember when living there, the first thing I noticed was there were no school buses. And so when I would hear people talk about kids having to cross gang territory, it hit me. I said, wait a minute. Well, if I got to take a city bus and I got to go through neighborhoods, because the school bus was actually something that was sort of a protector, if you will. That's something that's simple. The average person doesn't even realize they don't have in Chicago.
Well, you know, and it's really one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and we really wanted to dispel with this whole documentary piece is, you know, there's this narrative that goes around about the people who are having challenges, the people don't make it through, is because they're not working hard enough, or because they just need to, you know, they need to, you know, put more impact behind their efforts. And the truth is, there are structural challenges that sit in the way,
right,
of persistence. And as we're having this conversation about K-12, you know, we can get excited about students who are finishing high school and finishing high school degrees. But the truth is, when you think about this 21st century economy and where we find ourselves, access and persistence in higher education is going to matter. Access and persistence and credentialing in higher education is going to matter. And so if we're not thinking about the systemic structures that are keeping the financial, the academic, and the social transitions difficult for students, then I think we're just, you know, then I think we're making a mockery of the entire conversation. And that's really what we wanted to try to highlight with All the Difference. These success stories are here. We want to profile them, and we want to make them standard.
Robert, why did you want to participate in this?
Well, first off, thanks for having us here. I saw this as an opportunity for me to tell not only my story, but the community story as well. This movie is not about, you know, my life or Krishan's life, but it's about the bigger picture of really trying to get the community involved and see the issue that, you know, the minorities face trying to be the first generation to go to college and be successful.
And when you hear national media talk about Chicago, talk about the violence, the labels that are applied, how does that make you feel?
I really feel like you hit it right on the head, you know. You hit it right on the head when you would say that people don't really know what they're talking about, because they didn't really grow up in that area. They don't know the struggle of growing up in the area dangerous like the South Side of Chicago. You know, they only want to highlight all the negative, which we do have some, you know, some stuff we need to improve on. But it is some positive things that we are trying to do and improve on the South Side of Chicago, but yet the media don't like to cover that part.
The other piece is that, you know, that the neighborhoods that we live in and the communities that we live in, they aren't that way by accident, right? There are structural challenges. There's systemic racism, and there's things that have to be unwound and undone if we're talking about, you know, really making long-term improvements. There are structural disinvestments that have happened. And so as we're thinking about this and the role that higher ed and the role that education plays into that, that's really the thing that we want to try to profile and show, is that you cannot have a conversation about community reinvestment and to have a conversation about community impact if education and access for education for young men like Robert and Krishan are not at the center of that conversation.
Wes, your book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, certainly was a successful book. And how does that speak to this issue in terms of, was after doing that book, did that cause you to say, you know what, I need to be able to expand this concept beyond the book and to put it in broadcast form? Because it appears to me that chronicling their story is a way to say, folks need to see how there could be two fates for someone.
That's exactly right. And I think one thing that we saw and that I really realized, you know, the other Westmore was really the start of all the difference, was how exactly can we take these very real situations and take the narrative so people understand the human impact of these decisions. The other Westmore was not about a good West and a bad West. The other Westmore was not about a good mom and a bad mom. It was not about one kid getting sent away and the other kid didn't. It's about how do we think about our lives in an entirety, and why do the results of these lives matter? And so we wanted to do the same thing with All the Difference, right? Is take the life of Krishan and Robert and really make the viewer invested in them, invested in their success, understand that their winning does matter to all of us, and then being able to really have a deep explanation into their life as to what were the things that did make all the difference for their long-term success. They've changed the entire trajectory of their family, both Robert and Krishan. Why does that matter to all of us,
right,
if we're being serious about what it means to be patriotic in this country?
Wes, Robert, we appreciate it. All the Difference, folks. Ed will have his national broadcast premiere on the Point of View series September 12th, 10 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Gents, thanks a lot.
Bless you, Roland. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV.
Birthday shout out time. Jennifer Hudson turns 35. Reuben Studdard turns 38. Rapper 2 Chainz turns 39. Maybe got a third chain for his birthday. Bone Thugs and Harmony rapper Busy Bone turns 40. Folks, don't forget tomorrow on News One Now, we will have the Moral Majority March taking place 25 cities across the country today. Plus, part 2 of our exclusive with Harry Belafonte. You can hit me at Twitter, Roland S. Martin. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Holla!
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.